Good evening, everyone. Can you hear me okay? I have poor hearing, so I'm sure I'm not the only one. I want to say it is a great honor for me to be here, and I think you all know what a precious jewel you have here now in Brattleboro, that Hakusho has moved here and has opened this Brattleboro Zen Center. And you know, his 14 years as a monastic and all the leadership roles, it seems that you all have been blessed with a vast and deep teaching that is rare in the United States. And the extraordinarily kind and gentle and sweet man that he is another just sort of precious gift for all of us. And I know Hakusho through his most beloved dear wife, Marie, who I will say is yet another human being of sort of unparalleled character of compassion, intelligence, wisdom, and a lovely sense of humor and laugh. And I will say that we are blessed in this community that they are two bodhisattvas who live among us and really provide a real model for what it means to be a human being in the United States of America in 2024. So when Hakusho and I spoke, he suggested I try to approach something, a topic that was both alive for me and something that was relevant. And you know, as I thought about this, I realized that the people who tend to be involved in Zen and meditation are very serious about the world, and they take their lives with the utmost seriousness, and they use their contemplative life to not only be happy, but also to serve the world as effectively and as lovingly as possible. And before I forget, I want to say that the Peace Vigil folks who are on Main Street every Saturday, I want to thank you for what you all do. And I want to say that the impact that you have is something that it may be hard for you to assess. Your mere presence ripples literally through the universe and through this town, even though people may never speak to you about it. But please know that, in my opinion, that is surely the effect. So, as I think about the last few years, and you know, I don't know most of you, dear Marie, James, I met Vera before and some others. We live in tumultuous times. You know, I'm a political scientist. I've been teaching politics and history at mostly the college level for the last 30-plus years, and before that in different parts of the world. And the fact is that the world has always been tumultuous. At the time of the Buddha, one might be surprised that he had to deal with a sex scandal. He was accused of having sex with a woman in a particular retreat area outside of Magadha. He had to deal with three assassination attempts by his very close disciple and his first cousin, Devadatta. Devadatta tried to create a schism and take over the Sangha about 10 years before the Buddha died, and the Buddha died. Buddha said, "No deal, dude." And he went out in next years three times, literally tried to assassinate the Buddha. When the Buddha went back to Kapilavastu, where he grew up as a young man, or once he had become enlightened and he started to teach, he went back and his father-in-law would have nothing to do with him. His father-in-law tried to prevent him from going into town because he was so mad at the Buddha that the Buddha had left his daughter and young child, grandchild. And so the father-in-law tried to rally people against him. The Buddha traveled through incredibly dangerous areas. Eastern India at that time was mostly very, very thick forests. They couldn't cut it down until they had iron, until about 600, 700 BCE. Before, it was just forest. A tiger and an elephant could kill you like that. Elephants ran through Kapilavastu at nighttime, and they were terrified that they would run over children and run over people who were not very nimble. traveling through Eastern India where the Buddha did, he walked 200 miles at a time. He was enlightened, and then he ends up wherever he ends up for the, you know, Deer Park for his first talk. We're talking like 150 miles. And if you've been to India, it is hot and it's cold and there are no roads at the time. The point being is that, and again, we could run through history of the difficult times that humans have dealt with. And it's not a surprise. It's not a surprise that the Buddha's teaching is about the experience of life. This is what life is about, right? He goes through the three stages of enlightenment, and each one he has a greater and greater insight. It was that experience of what his mind went through, his body-mind experience, that led to his particular teachings. But the point is that, and when the Buddha talks about the first noble truth of dukkha, is that life is characterized by suffering. And again, if you go online and it says Four Noble Truths, you'll often see the first noble truth, life is suffering. That's not what the sutras say. Life is characterized by suffering. The Buddha talked about the many joys of the world, the joys of being a wife and a parent and a child and a sibling and a business person who took care of their workers. He talked about the joys of the world. The point being is that when we talk, we see ourselves at this time in history as something exceptional. In fact, from my experience, and again, I teach history and politics, and if you teach politics, you have to base all of your political understanding on the history. And anyways, but the point being is that the Buddha saw an enormous amount of suffering. You know, during his time, his close king friend, supporter, Bimbisara and Magadha, the most powerful state in all of India, unifies India for the first time in history. The Buddha was very close to the kings because he knew if not, the kings could destroy his Sangha in a matter of days. These were the days where they first had armies and they had chariots and they had horses and they had swords that could kill you very quickly. The point being is that we talk about that life is characterized by suffering today in 2024. It's always been that way. The one thing I think is different is the existential crisis with the climate. That's different. In terms of violence, poverty, the rest of it. The stories are horrendous. Read about Genghis Khan and what he did all throughout Asia and to Europe and the Middle East. Terrifying. You know, 7, 8 of the greatest cities in the world were absolutely just about razed and people butchered and enslaved. Just unbelievable violence. But the point being is the fact that this is what our lives are about, is the fact that suffering is the nature. It's part of it, and it's also joy, and it's wonder, and it's laughter, and it's all of that as well. And so the topic that has come to mind for me, or came to mind for me, is how do we deal with the issues in front of us politically and socially? And if I didn't say it, I meant to say is that those folks who are Dharma practitioners tend to be very politically aware, very much in tune with what's going on, feel the pain of the world very, very deeply. And so in terms of trying to share some thoughts, it seemed to me it may be helpful, might be appropriate. To share my sort of understanding of, you know, how do we cope with all this suffering? And Lord knows we all have, you know, I mean, if we went through the health issues, I'm 69. The list goes long when we get to 50s and 60s and 70s, right, in terms of health. I work at hospice, you know, with a woman, a new person, and her husband just died like 3 days ago. You know, her whole life is now very different. And so the question is, how do we do this? How do we deal with this? And one of the things I love about this gesture, this mudra, in gassho meaning putting one's hands together, often called the salutation mudra, if you've been to Asia, East Asia, places like India in particular, is that people bow all the time. I mean, we bow, we good Buddhists bow all the time, right? I mean, Hakusho bowed like 15, we all bowed about 15, 20 times. It's really lovely. It's a beautiful gesture, right? And, you know, you go to a place like India, people, you know, it's hello, it's goodbye, it's thank you, or it's, oh, hi, I respect you very much. It's a lovely, lovely gesture. And one of the things that comes to mind for me when I think about the Gassho is the fact that in many ways, this embodies our practice. This embodies our life. And traditionally, the left hand of the Gassho was really about ego. It's our sort of selfish nature. It's our sense of self. It's our wants and desires. It's our opinions, especially our sort of negative opinions, especially the stuff we hang on to, the stuff that we're a pain in the ass. That's sort of the left hand. Here it is. And the most extreme, and from a Buddhist perspective, is greed, anger, and ignorance, you know, when you take it to a greater degree. So here we are, all of us. Here we are. And at the same time, we have the right hand, right? In theory, it symbolizes awakening, enlightenment, sort of letting go of the ego, letting go of our opinions, letting go of our attachments. I am somebody. I am this. I am that. Who gives a shit? Really? How much do we carry that is the question. So here's the thing, is that when we put these two together, we have the reality of our practice. There is the reality of our lives and our ego-centered self, even as we're trying to let it go as much as possible. And then there is all of that sort of incredible compassion and lightness and openness and sort of freedom that we live with, in which that we really move freely in the world. And so how do we bring these two things together? And so the question I have for tonight and what I'm going to share is just a few thoughts on how do we bring these two things together? How do we recognize the reality of ourself? And I love, you know, one of my favorite Buddhist writers, a guy named David Lloyd, and he talks and others about the sense of self. And so, as many of you probably know, in Buddhism, we talk about no self, that there is no self, right? That this is it's a construction, as we say in good sort of modern social sciences. This is a construct, right? Form, perception, reaction, consciousness, et cetera. And that this sense of self is more sort of how we see ourselves in the world. And it's a sense, which means it's like a perception. It's not a reality necessarily. And so, you know, the question is, how do we navigate with this sense of self in a world in which we're trying to let go of that self? We're trying to let go of those identities, or let go of the ego that we carry with it. You know, when do people make us mad? It's often because they say something that doesn't quite match our sense of ourselves. And it's interesting for me, you know, as a political scientist, I study a lot of international relations, is that there's our individual self, and then there's our collective sense of self. You know, just look at the Olympics, right? The Olympics is really, in many ways, a beautiful idea, right? In many ways, it's carried out in a beautiful way. People compete, but they also sort of love the competitors, and they take care of them. Someone falls down, they pick them up. It's not about we're going to win at all costs. And the fact is that we, Olympics, you know, they have to be fair. I mean, this is the real accountability, which is not always the case. And yet, of course, so there's this sense of identity. We're Americans, right? Most of us are Americans, or a combination of Americans in other countries or other nationalities. And so that could be a lovely thing, but think of all the sort of imperial endeavors throughout human history. You know, at the time of the Buddha, if you became a king, this is a time the transition went from these like small sort of councils sort of elite councils where mostly the men would all get together, the families and the clans, and they would make more or less sort of Republican, sort of Democratic decisions. But by the time of the Buddha, 102 years ago, you know, the technology changed, iron came, the second urbanization, lots of money came, super, super, super rich people, and there was a consolidation of power. And what happened is that these folks came to power, and so the monarchies developed in India at that time. And he was a very smart politician, the Buddha, because his two best, you know, professional friends were the two most powerful men in all of India, the two kings of Kosala and Magadha. And so, but the point being is that if you became king, your job was to spread power, was to conquer people, which means you kill and rape and enslave them. There was the old, this is sort of before his time, there was the tradition in India during the Vedic times and before the Brahmin times, is the fact that if there were what the early kings, they would send a horse out in the course of a year, this beautiful horse, and any place that the horse covered in the course of a year, the king would go and conquer it if the people did not grant, just allow him to do so. That was his job, was to conquer foreign people, and the unbelievable suffering that went into that. This is the world where the Buddha grew up. But the point being here is the fact that, you know, the sense of collective identity can both be a beautiful thing and also a can be a tremendously dangerous thing, and it's a huge part of our world. So the question is, you know, we are living in this world, all sorts of problems. We have global warming, the situation in Gaza, the situation in Sudan. I mean, choose your country, and there is an enormous amount of pain. All you have to do is walk out about 100 feet from here on the streets of Brattleboro, and the level of physical, human, you know, emotional pain is just overflowing. Heartbreaking story after story after story after story. So how do we make sense of this? How do we sort of live with this at the same time of being compassionate, loving, and kind, and have equanimity in our lives? You know, you look at Thich Nhat Hanh, who's passed, obviously, if you ever see him, either videos or in person, or the Dalai Lama. Break your heart? Listen to their stories about their lives. You know, the Dalai Lama in particular is obviously still with us. You know, the Chinese have committed genocide culturally and otherwise in Tibet. I mean, he barely escaped with his life going over the Himalayas when he was still a teenager. And, you know, he's been in exile forever, you know. And the amount of suffering that he has gone through, I think, is hard for us to imagine. And how does he live such a buoyant life? You know, how does he do that? You know, when I talk to my beloved children, my dear wife, you know, they carry the suffering of the world very heavily, and it sort of gets stuck in their stomach. And I try to, they don't ask me much, but in as subtle as way, talk about the fact that it's about, you know, this pain sort of moving through us. And it's not that we're not aware of it, it's the fact that we simply have to let it go through us and be aware of it, but not let us sort of bring it down. And so what I want to do is talk a little bit. One of my absolute favorite superheroes is Joanna Macy. And she's a Buddhist teacher and scholar, and she's in her 90s, and I've had the chance to see her, not in person, but in videos, in various capacities, in context. And I think she's one of the great figures in the world, from my sort of little sense of it. And her whole work for the last 40 or 50 years is how to deal with grief in the world, grief for pain and suffering and loss. She has trained literally hundreds of thousands of people. And she went through a number of organizations. Her most recent one is called The Work That Reconnects. But before it was like about grief and sadness and stuff, but she went through three iterations. And she's written probably five books. And I just think she's a remarkable teacher. And she proposes three ways for us to understand the world together. And she calls these stories. She says there are three stories that are at work. The first story is business as usual story. And each one of these stories has a following. I'm talking mostly about the United States, but you know, what we go through happens in other countries. It's like Trump said that, oh, I'm really won the election and we're going to take over the government. And then you have his buddy Bolsonaro in Brazil, literally like a year later, doing exactly the same thing. This is not a coincidence. But the point being is the fact that each of these stories have a constituency. People in this country follow, and they're different. So the first story that they talk about, that she talks about, this is her thinking here, is what's called business as usual. And she's really focused on the climate crisis and everything that sort of goes along with it. Business as usual is the opinion, an opinion that everything's basically okay, and that technology will take care of everything. We don't have to really do much, right? We don't have to worry about global warming. We don't have to worry about, you know, miles per gallon in cars. We don't have to worry about that stuff. Just go on as usual. The second story that's prevalent is the great unraveling. That is the opinion of those who argue that we're doomed. There's no hope for us. We're a bunch of greedy, stupid, silly human beings, and we never change unless we're forced to, because there's a crisis that's so bad that we have to change, otherwise we're all gonna die. And these folks basically argue that by the time people wake up to the crisis, it's gonna be over, and therefore we're just, say sayonara. And therefore, you know, you don't really have to do much. Do whatever you want, but it's over for all intents. She embraces the third story. It's called The Great Turning. What's his name? Spiritual activist. One of these writers, spiritual activist, sacred activism. Anyways, he wrote the book Sacred Activism. So he's a spiritual guy, he's a mystic, as well as a political guy. And he argues that there are between 1 and 2 million nonprofits or organizations in the world that are working toward sustainability. 1 to 2 million around the world. And these are part of a political movement that we don't hear anything about, but at the grassroots is alive and well. And she calls it the Great Turning. And this is number one, those who are working politically to try to make a difference in terms of global warming and everything that goes with it. The other piece of it is that the Great Turning is also on a personal level. It's when we are able to take the pain of the world, open ourselves to the pain of the world, embrace the pain of the world, and recognize that anxiety, that worry, that despair that may come from literally feeling the pain of the world. In fact, if we turn that upside down, what it is our love for the world. So our despair is only because we love the world so much. And then she takes the next step, and here's the turning. If we love the world that much, we're not going to sit on our asses and do nothing. We're going to decide for us who we are, how to get involved in that. And she uses the analogy of what happens when our mothers are dying of cancer. There's 6 months to go. I went through this with my mother. A lot of us have gone through this. 6 months to live, it's brutal. She's in pain, she's incoherent, she's soiling the sheets, she's being belligerent. She used to be the sweetest person in the world, and now she's like another person. And your heart is breaking. She says terrible things to you. It's like, if we didn't love our mother so much, it wouldn't hurt. Are we not going to attend to her? Are we not going to clean her? Are we not going to feed her? Are we not going to do what's necessary in order to alleviate, to the degree possible, her pain in the world? And the answer is, hell no, we're not gonna, we're sure as hell gonna do it. Of course we are. One of her recent books is called, Joanna Macy's, something like The Wild Love of the World. And so the piece that she's proposing here is that, number one, we do not deny the pain. We honor the pain. We're human beings. We feel this stuff. We're aware of it. To suppress it means it'll come out sideways, some way. And she basically argues that, if you will, the left hand of our gassho is the very narrow view of the world, where we're basically just going to deal with the stuff that's easy for us, the people who are like us, not the people who are different, not the people who are drunk on the side of the street, not the people who have dark skin, not the people who are, you know, homosexual, whatever. Whatever it may, you know, here is the narrow view of the world. And so to wake up to the fullness of this life means that we go from constriction to literally, it's like the entire world. And so when we talk about the Dharma, the teaching, and also the very existence on this life, we're talking about the entire universe. And so the way for us, Macy and others are arguing, is that the way we deal with our pain is to open ourselves to it. And in the process, we open ourselves to the entire world. And it could be Sudan, it could be down on Main Street in Brattleboro, Vermont. But for us, our heart is that big. I will tell you that, and some of you have heard this a little bit before, but when I was 11 years old, my father died. We woke up one morning, I went downstairs, my mother's crying, she goes, "Daddy is dead." He left 8 children between 2 months and 12 years old. I was the 11-year-old oldest boy. So my mother raised 8 of us without a husband. And one of the things I realized at that young age is the fact that my suffering was, in fact, the suffering of other people. They had their own thing. It wasn't their father necessarily, but it was something else. And I realized that my heart bled 24 hours a day. It has bled 24 hours a day, and I knew this as a young kid, because my father was never coming back. There was a hole in my heart that, as a young boy, it wasn't going to heal. It's just a fact. And there was a sort of stream of sad blood that just has flowed ever since. In the process, though, what I learned, and what Joanna Macy is talking about, is the ability to love the world. For the grace of God, I had my father for 11 years. For the grace of God, he was a wonderful man. He was a wonderful father and husband. People respected him. And for the rest of my life, I carry that legacy. So through the pain of his literally disappearance, there I am, 11-year-old boy, reading the Hartford Times 12 hours after he died. I'm reading Tuck Red in 39, businessman dies, and then go to all the wonderful things he did. And at that moment, I said, oh, I never thought about this word, but this word now I take very seriously, and that word is forever. And I said, oh, this is what forever is. As much as I wanted to, I looked for him in the crowd as a young boy. Maybe he wasn't really dead. Forever, he ain't coming back. The pain that we all feel in this lifetime, reflects the love that we have for the world. And what Joanna Macy is offering us is a way to transform our sadness. And not that it disappears, but it's accompanied by joy and gratitude. And I'll end in just a couple of minutes here. She provides four sort of steps along the way to do this. And she wrote, it's worth it. Joanna Macy is her name. Active Hope is one of her recent books. And just remarkable stuff. She says, number one is that in terms of our lives, in terms of dealing with pain and sadness, we begin with gratitude. But for the grace of God go I. All the things, especially those of us who live in the United States of America, middle class Americans, it's like, holy shit, man. Compared to, you know, people lived to the age of 40 through most of human history. Till about 1800, everybody in the world lived to 40. That was it. You know, the Buddha lived supposedly to 83, but man, that was like, because he was like a superman. So number one is gratitude. As much pain as we are in, we are grateful. Number two is to honor our pain. To honor the pain that we're in. Oh, what am I gonna forget? Ah, I love this one. The third has to do with seeing. So gratitude, honor our pain, and then seeing with new eyes. And what she's saying is the fact that there's all sorts of ways for us to look at our lives. We can be a victim about all sorts of stuff if we really try hard. I love Thich Nhat Hanh's poem, Call Me By My True Name. It's a stunningly beautiful and crushingly heartbreaking poem. He talks about being a flower and all this beautiful stuff. And then he talks about being a, some of you who are, those of us who are old enough, remember the Vietnamese boat people. Right after the Vietnam War, the Viet Cong came in, the communists came in 75, and a whole bunch of people fled because they were killing all sorts of people. And a lot of those folks ended up boat people in the Bay of Thailand, right? And there were all these Thai pirates. You've ever been to Thailand and you're on the coast, be careful for Thai pirates. These are guys who come in with these super fast boats and they go into the hotels with all these foreigners are, and they steal everything, they get back in their boats, and the Thai police will never catch them. So anyways, so at that point in Thailand, the Thai pirates were raping women in these boats who were desperate leaving the Vietnamese communists. So in Thai, Thich Nhat Hanh's poem, he says, I am the young girl who jumped out to drown herself after being raped by the Thai pirate. And we go, oh yeah, I can see that. That's horrible, you know. And then the next line he goes, and I am the Thai pirate who was abused by his father growing up who raped that young girl. Seeing with new eyes means, in Buddhist terms, we talk about, causes and conditions. Causes and conditions lead to what happens in the world. There are causes and there are conditions. And interdependency, interbeing, all this other good stuff. We see with new eyes when we step outside of our narrow and we literally open ourselves to the world. And the last thing is that she talks about going forth. And going forth means that we live our lives with a certain amount of freedom. We carry the sadness, but our heart is so big that we're able to sort of move freely in the world and really enjoy the sort of incredible gift that this life is for us. So I will end there. You've been incredibly patient, and it's been a real honor. So thank you.